Well, hey, here we are. It's another Books of the Year podcast. Sorry that we've been away doing other things, but it's just the way it goes. I think Matt's been busy.
Yeah.
He certainly hasn't been busy buying a new laptop or anything like that, but.
No, well, this is my son's laptop that we're on. So obviously, you're about to hear our interview with Ragnar, and we're recording this intro after we've recorded that. Unfortunately, my son's laptop isn't much of an improvement on my laptop, which is from the Stone Age. So, you know, we'll persist with it.
When's your birthday?
Not long. It's a couple of weeks. Couple of weeks, everyone. If you want to buy me a new laptop, that would be great.
Well, yes. I was thinking maybe Mrs. Williams might want to chip in there, just for all our sakes.
Spring in for a decent laptop. It might be the Wi-Fi. I don't know.
I think it could be that as well. Anyway, Ragnar Jonasson is on the way. Whilst we've been away, Wally Funk, who was on the show a couple of summers ago.
Oh, wow, yeah.
A long time ago. Is going into space with Jeff Bezos at the age of 82. Who's this? Joe Smith says, this woman is amazing. I read about the Mercury 13 and I'm angry she didn't get to go back then. Happy for her now. Have you got some of this stuff, Matt?
Yes. Frances Crossland also said, I heard it on the 8 o'clock news. I was so happy for her. Her appearance on your podcast was special. The book so interesting. Making history again. Go Wally. My own recollection of that was I asked her a question when we were doing the interview. She did not like the question that I was asking her. And the look on her face was very much making it clear that I should very much back off. Helen Russell, author of A Year of Living Danishly, has tweeted us, said, loved hearing Ben McIntyre talking about Agent Sonya, which is another of those great Ben McIntyre books. I think his next one's about Colditz. I cannot wait for that. She says, packed with jaw-dropping moments, but possibly the most shocking was the children were each allowed 4 fizzy drinks and 3 ice creams. 3 ice creams, says Helen. My kids go bananas on one. Who was this woman? Hashtag just read. Tracy Lasham emails finally say, by chance, I found your podcast a couple of weeks ago. How would you manage to stay hidden for so long? It took me back to a different time when I listened to you both on 5 Live. I had 122 episodes to catch up with, and I must say that I think I'm powering through them quite well. I've just listened to the first of 2019, where Matt is stuck in traffic, but the reason I'm emailing is because a couple of the previous ones, Roger Daltrey and Robin Ince, begin with you two talking about how bad things were and how you didn't think they could get any worse.
Yes.
And yet they did. It's so strange to hear you chatting as I sit here in 2021. Anyway, keep up the good work. I absolutely love listening to you both, and I often laugh loudly at you, so you properly cheer up my day. 5 stars, obviously.
Oh, yeah, which goes back to when we actually asked people to review us favourably. I mean, but now I listen to podcasts, and everybody asked to be rated as 5 stars, and it makes us sound a little bit cheap. But anyway, okay.
It also means that those ratings can't really matter, can they? If everyone's 5 stars, then, you know, what's the point in having a rating system? That's my personal feeling.
Yeah. Well, that's very fair. Anyway, if you want to get in touch, you can email booksoftheyear@yahoo.com or you can tweet us at Books of the Year, and we would love to hear from you and include you in our next show, which will be in a couple of weeks' time with John Boyne, who's got another book. I mean, John Boyne is like a machine.
He is amazing.
Astonishing output. As I struggle to finish like one book every 2 years. There's John Boyne, another amazing book. We'll be speaking to John in a couple of weeks. However, he's our next guest because the guest who's coming up on this show is live from Reykjavik. Here we are. Are you in Reykjavik, Ragnar?
I am actually, yes.
Well, let me tell you something. Matt and I both would have experienced, not that we live together, I'm not saying
no.
Most people in the UK. At like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning that's just passed, would have thought, this is too hot. Ugh. I'm going to have to open the window. I don't know how I'm going to survive the night because the heat is so amazing. And it did occur to me, I would rather be in Reykjavik because the nights are easier there. True?
No, I don't think you'd rather be here. It's quite miserable. It's like 12 degrees and cloudy. So.
Yeah, well, you know, that has a lot to be said for it, I think. As you can see from Matt's face, Ragnar, he's been out in the sun.
Yeah.
I think he was running a barbecue.
I had barbecue on Saturday night,
Yeah, you have more daylight than we do, but you can see what Matt's done with his. He's not put on any factor 50. Oh, and this camera's just disappeared, which is... Yeah. Frankly, your laptop has just decided, you know what, let's not.
Yeah.
Anyway, the crucial thing about a podcast is the sound, so we appreciate the fact that everyone's microphone is still working. I have to say, I mean, I mentioned this to Matt a couple of times. I've been to Iceland a couple of times, and anyone who goes to Iceland becomes, I think, like evangelical about the place. They just talk about it with. I mean, if you haven't been, it's probably very boring. But I cannot wait to go back. Obviously, we can't actually go anywhere at the moment, but it's just, you know, the culture. Every country is unique, and I hate exceptionalism in any kind of country and the people from a country, but there is something unique and extraordinary about your country, Ragnar, which I think is one of the reasons why you have so many writers and such extraordinary artistic output.
It is quite a special place. I can agree, and that you know, there is something, you know, especially in the summertime, there is something magical about the long days, the long nights, no darkness, and that's the time of year when I usually try not to write. I just try to be, you know, stay up as long as I can and enjoy this strange phenomenon that is the summer nights in Iceland.
How is it? Before we discuss the girl who died, how is it possible to be one of the most highly acclaimed crime writers in the world, as it says on the front of the book? Is this the best crime writer in the world today? Is a quote from the Times, and yet you still have another job. You know, you're not a full time writer. This seems crazy to me.
Yeah, it sometimes seems crazy to me as well, actually. But the reason I still do it is just for the. It's, you know, writing is kind of a lonely profession, and you don't meet a lot of people, especially, you know, in the past, you know, year and a half. So having a place to go to work every day is something that, you know, you learn to treasure. You know, meet new people and have something to different to focus on. Mm. But it is getting more difficult, you know, by the day, by the month, to try to do both.
Yeah. Well, sorry about that. You keep on being so successful as a writer. It must be unbearable for you. So that's and here we go with a standalone book, which is The Girl Who Died. Not one of your series. This is standalone. Introduce us to this book, and introduce us to this extraordinarily lonely place up in the north of Iceland that you're writing about.
Yes. So I'd written a couple of series, and I thought I wanted to do something very different. So I found this place. It's called Skálar, and it's on the. It's basically as far away from Reykjavik as you can get. If you draw a straight line on a map from Reykjavik to the northeast part of Iceland, this is where you would end up. And so I thought, you know, what if I create a character, in this case, a young woman, a teacher in Reykjavik in the 1980s, and she's tired of her life in Reykjavik and she wants to, you know, change, do something different. She sees an ad in the paper for a teacher at the end of the world, basically. So she moves to this place. It's called Skálar, and it used to be a real village. It used to be a place where people lived, quite a few years ago. It was during the Second World War and a little while after that. But now it's an abandoned village. So I went there and I visited, and it was quite magical. It was quite there are these ruins of old houses, and it's so far away from everything, and it's so empty and so cold. And for me, it was the perfect place to choose. And she goes there in the start of winter, basically, to teach two children, and it's a village of 10, so it's one of the smallest villages you can think of. And she spends a winter there, and she's really does not feel welcome at all, and she even thinks the house she's staying in might be haunted. And so this is the book about, you know, this woman, Una, and her winter in Scaller. And of course, you know, during the course of the winter, someone dies quite tragically, and she has to try and figure out what happened. And we don't have, you know, we hardly have any police presence or anything like that. So it's not the police procedural. It's quite different, I think.
Yeah. There's something I was finishing off yesterday in the garden, Ragnar, where it was 31 degrees. There is something about reading it in extreme heat, about the depths and the remoteness of the of Skála in Iceland. A fantastic contrast it was. And can you just explain a bit about why it's the mid 1980s? Is that so that you could write about Skála with people in it? Because you mentioned it's deserted now.
Actually, it wasn't, because in the 1980s it was deserted as well. But the reason is, for me, it's a charming era, the 1980s. Everything's a little bit more innocent, especially in Iceland. But most importantly, we don't have any internet, we don't have any mobile phones or anything that, like that, which I think usually ruins a good crime story.
That's a cheat. That's a complete cheat, isn't it? You know, mobile phones and computers, that's a little bit annoying. I know, I'll set it in the mid-80s. Oh, well, there you go. I guess you're entitled to do that, given that you are one of the world's leading crime writers. Just before Matt comes in, can I just ask you, Ray, it's quite a while before, because you mentioned someone dies, and it's quite a while, obviously the title suggests who it might be. Do you play with the supernatural just a little bit more than a writer who wouldn't be from Iceland? Because for a while it feels like a ghost story.
Yeah. I mean, Icelanders, I think, tend to be quite superstitious and you know, believe in the supernatural to an extent. I mean, I don't think you would necessarily find a lot of Icelanders who really believe in ghosts, but they sort of believe in some sort of, you know, the force of nature in some way, because we, you know, traditionally we, you know, our ancestors have had to live off the land here and try and survive in these harsh conditions that used to be and sometimes still are in Iceland. So I mean, that is probably true, and I had a lot of fun, you know, doing a little bit of the supernatural here, even though I was very careful that it would never be the essence of the book. And for each reader, it's basically up to you to decide if you want to believe in a ghost or not. But it's most certainly not the solution does not hinge on that in any way. But I had fun with it, and it was really the first time I've done anything like that, but it's not something I would probably use in more books. But it's sort of fitting for this village, because it is a little bit, it is a strange place, and you can, you know, maybe you can believe that this is a place where you might possibly find a ghost.
I want to talk to you about that sort of sense of isolation, Ragnar, because reading the book, clearly this Skála, this place you found, is miles from anywhere and so isolated. And I know I'm really interested in those sort of genres of fiction where you put the setting in somewhere that's so isolated. And there are good dramatic reasons for that. In other words, you know, the police can't get involved. It's all got to be solved by the people who are in that community. But also it appeals to that part of all of us where we're sort of like, we want to get away from it all. And of course, we've all had the last 18 months or so where we've all had to be in our homes. So in effect, even if you've been living in a city, you've been getting away from it all because you've just had to be alone in your own house. But what I really liked about the book is that, you know, getting away from it all is great until you realise that the Skála shop is only open between 3 and 5, and they can't get the newspapers for like 2 or 3 days afterwards. And also, you know, the community, being in that sort of really small community, is great until they start slagging off how you drink your coffee. Literally, how she drinks her coffee. They are criticizing how she... I'm like, she just wants to have a coffee black. What's wrong with having your coffee with no milk in it? And it's... I love all that, the sort of the atmosphere you're creating of, this might sound great. The idea of getting away from it all might sound great, but there's the sort of what I would probably call the deliverance side of it as well, where you're like, okay, maybe I don't want to live here long term. You're talking to us from Reykjavik. So would you describe yourself as somebody who's very much a city person, or someone who fantasizes about getting away from it all, as many of us have?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, you absolutely do. And sometimes you just, you know, you think it might be a good idea to go somewhere far away and just, you know, write or experience something totally different. But I agree with you. I mean, this place that I write about in the book, it's definitely not somewhere I would actually want to live. And I think I've made it quite clear that this is not a friendly place, at least in the book. And, you know, and weather-wise and in every sense, it's a very harsh place in real life to live. And, you know, which is apparent by the fact that the village isn't there anymore. I mean, people just couldn't really, really stay there. But, I mean, I think it's a place you might hopefully want to read about, but you wouldn't really want to go there.
I was thinking also, Ragnar, that obviously when anyone writes a story, a sense of place is obviously incredibly important. But if you're writing a story in Iceland, the weather and landscape is inescapable. You know, if you write a story based in London, obviously you have to, you know, you might talk about the tube, or you might talk about the busy streets or whatever. But if you're writing in Iceland, the weather and landscape is front and center pretty much all the time.
Yeah, I think we're quite fortunate in that respect. I mean, we have this fantastic country and this... and as I mentioned earlier, I mean, if I drive 30 minutes out of Reykjavik, I'm in a place called Thingvellir, which is the old parliament place, outdoors, and heritage site, basically, and which is... has absolutely stunning nature, and you really don't have to go far to find places like that. And if you drive around the country, there are so many interesting places. And so writing a book set in Iceland, I mean, you really have to use this. You have to take advantage of this in a way. And so that's what I've tried to do, is try to find these strange places, whether they're, you know, sometimes it's like stunning nature and sometimes it's just desolate places that are real. Absolutely. Writing books in Iceland, I feel that it's sort of your duty to make use of this country and this strange nature that we have, and also the weather, because we have all sorts of weather. We can have beautiful days, and but then if you go into the highlands in whatever, any time of year, it gets dangerous, because you can get lost. You can expect, you know, snow in summer or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know whether Matt's still with us or not. He's looking at the screen here. He appears, then he disappears. His signal is rubbish, then his signal comes back again.
Oh, dear. Yeah. I'm not sure whether you can hear me or not.
Yeah, I can hear you. Ragnar has been very tolerant. Ragnar, thank you. Bear with us. So, Matt, do you want to go? Long as you can hear me, do you want to try a question?
Yes, I'll try a question. I'll keep it tight. I want to talk about booze, Ragnar, because Una, the main character here, all she wants is to have a drink. And what's wrong with that? Nothing at all. And yet, it's very much frowned on in Scowler. She can't get it's almost as if she's buying moonshine. It's such a nightmare getting hold of a bottle of wine. Simon, as he said, has been to Iceland. I've never been to Iceland, but I wondered whether is alcohol really frowned on as much in sort of wider Icelandic society as it clearly is in Skála?
It isn't. But in these, actually in the 1980s, beer was not legal in Iceland in 1986 when the book takes place. It wasn't until 1989 that the prohibition of beer was abolished. It had been, it had lasted from 1915 to 1989 in Iceland. And so we were probably one of the, last countries in the world to make beer legal. Although, strong alcohol was not forbidden. So it was quite a strange time. People tell me that, people who were, enjoying life in those days, you had to drink strong alcohol, but not beer. But also in these smaller villages, what I'm basically working with in the story is, the smaller the community gets, the more inquisitive people are, the more judgmental they may be, especially towards a stranger in town. So, and Una, she certainly does like her red wine, and it is hard to have a hobby like that in a town of only 10.
Why was it that it was so late before beer was okay to drink, and yet you could get as much, hard liquor as you wanted? What was the thinking behind that?
I don't know what the thinking was. It's just sort of old-fashioned way of thinking, I think, from politicians at that time. I really struggled to see the justification, and people sort of make fun of it. Now they make fun of the politicians who were actually against it. There were some people who voted, against it in 1989, and it seems so obvious now. But it's a small community. Iceland is really, and so it's just like a thing of the past, which makes no sense now, really.
The residue of that, Ragnar, is that going out for a few drinks is incredibly expensive. And there was one party in Reykjavik who clearly came out for like a stag weekend where their intention was to drink a lot. And our first night, a gin and tonic and a glass of wine was £25. And that was considered absolutely...
Goodness me.
That's the way it is. So, if you want to go out and just drink a lot, don't go to Iceland. You can go to Iceland for many other reasons. But just on the subject of the politics... Ragnar and the small community. Can you tell us about your prime minister, who, if I understand this right, not only do you know, this is Katrin Jakobsdottir, I think I've got that right, but she knows a lot about crime fiction, so she's very much immersed in all of this. Tell us about your prime minister.
Yes, so Katrin has been our prime minister for the past 4 years and is seeking re-election this September. And she actually, before she went into politics, she wrote her thesis in literature at the university on Icelandic crime fiction some years ago. And she has been sort of Iceland's preeminent authority on crime fiction. And although she's put more of her time into politics in the past few years or the past decade, she's been the Minister of Culture as well before she became the Prime Minister. We're friends, so we've been working together on we've been together on a judging panel for the past 5 or 6 years, judging the best translated crime fiction in Iceland, and that's the only job in a way that she kept when she became prime minister, the only sort of extra hobby that she still wanted to do. And then it was about, a year, maybe a year or two ago that I met her for lunch, and I suggested, maybe we should write a crime novel together. And she agreed to that. So that's been on the cards for a while. But what happened, right after this lunch, we were hit by this pandemic, and we really haven't. The story is still being developed. But we finish that in the next couple of years.
You mentioned translation. Your book is translated by Victoria Crib, so we should mention her because these are her, she is translating your words. Your English is very good. Ragnar, do you read your books in English? Have you ever been tempted to write in English yourself?
So Vicky is a fantastic translator. I'm so pleased to have her, and she's brought these books to life. And before that, I had another fantastic translator called Quentin Bates. So I'm really thankful for the translators of this world, because without them, you know, my books would probably only be read in Icelandic. But I have I've never really given it. I have translated books from English to Icelandic as a hobby, but I've never thought of translating my own work. But I have written in English directly on occasion, but that's been for short stories. I mean, if I'm commissioned to write a short story, for English language magazine or book, I would usually just write it in English because it's easier. But to write a full novel in English, I haven't really tried, and I think I'm better off with my fantastic translators.
Agatha Christie gets a mention in the book. Didn't you translate Agatha Christie into Icelandic when you were younger? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking for a job when I was 17. I was in college and I needed something to do for the summer. So I was a big Agatha Christie fan, and I went to the... my mom, actually, I didn't even have a license to drive at that time, so my mom drove me to the publisher of Agatha Christie in Iceland, a very kind gentleman who took me well. And I said, you know, you may know me because I've been calling you every year for the past few years to ask you, you know, ask what Agatha Christie book are you publishing this year, etc. Because I was their biggest fan, and I said, you know, would you like me to translate a book for you for Christmas? And he gave it some thought, and then he called me back a few days later and said, you know, let's try this. And I was so surprised, you know, to give a 17-year-old the chance to actually translate a whole book. And he said I could pick any book I wanted, so I went to my shelves, which was filled with Agatha Christie books and in English, and I picked the shortest one I could find because I had no idea how long it would take to translate a whole novel. But that, you know, somehow that worked, and I did that for over 10 years, one book every year, while I was in school and when I graduated and started working. So that was really my hobby and sort of the gateway into actually, you know, finding the courage to write my own books.
I'm interested that you bring up Agatha Christie there, Ragnar, because it really, all this book really did bear the hallmarks of that. And I think the biggest clue is the fact that one of the things I love about Agatha Christie is that if you are paying attention very early on in the books, you get a very strong clue as to what's going on. And it is pretty early on in your book that there is this clue. There's a great, I'm not obviously going to mention the ending, but the ending is really strong and it is hinted at. Very, very. In fact, I think it's hinted at on the front cover, which is amazing. I mean, imagine the nerve of that, being able to put a massive clue on your front cover. Was that is that been a deliberate thing that you've thought? You know, this is a sort of a part of Agatha Christie's writing that I'd like to bring into my own, of just giving people that heads up that you can go, that you can literally turn back 200 pages and go, ah, I was, you know, he was trying to tell me something in that sort of paragraph back there.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think I've tried to learn a lot from Agatha Christie, and one of the things that she did so well is, you know, hide these clues in plain sight and try to have a twist at the end that seems so obvious when you reach the ending. And for me, I mean, it's always my goal to have a surprise at the end for the reader and some sort of a twist. And as you mentioned there, I mean, we have actually the clue on the cover, which I thought was quite a nice thing to do. And we had to tread very carefully when my friends at Penguin were writing the cover text and the summary for the book, because you really had to get it right to not ruin it for everyone.
Yeah, Matt, do you want to describe the cover? Just because I should have done it at the beginning, but it's certainly, having talked about the cover, you should probably just tell us what's on it.
Yeah. So it's a, I mean, this shouts out thriller. It's a mainly black cover, and the picture itself is this desolated, well, it looks like a barn, really, with just one light. It shouts out isolation. It's dominated by, as I say, this dark, cloudy sky behind it. And then in big, bold white letters, the girl who died, and underneath it, the tagline, "Welcome to Scowler, population 10 and falling." And then Ragnar Jonasson's name at the bottom. It's a great tagline, by the way.
Yeah, population 10 and falling. That's terrific. Any people go, yep, okay. I need to read this book. And just, I don't want to labor the Agatha Christie point, but given that it's been so much a part of your heritage, that sense that we were talking about, you know, setting it in the 80s without computers, without mobile phones, the fact that you have a very small cast, and obviously from the cover, a small cast and getting smaller, is just the perfect thriller backdrop, isn't it? You seem to love working with a small amount of people.
Yeah, I actually absolutely do. And that gives you the opportunity to explore each one in more depth and look into the psychology of the characters rather than some external clues. It really gives you an opportunity to sort of go in depth. And the fewer the characters, the better really it is. Although, you know, the fewer the characters, the more challenging it becomes to hide the truth from the reader. I did a book a couple of years ago that had basically three characters in it, set in a farmhouse at Christmas in a snowstorm. And I really enjoy doing that. I have, you know, been tempted with the idea of trying to write a book about only two characters, possibly even just one. I don't know how that would work, but basically, I mean, it is, it's sort of my hobby to try and limit the number of suspects without making everything too obvious.
It's the book is dedicated to your father, and he also gets a mention in the little author's note. You him specifically. Did he have knowledge of the area, Ragnar? Was he able to help you with that?
No, but what he has done, and both my father and my mother have done, is, you know, they have always encouraged me from just the age of, I don't know, six, seven, just to write and keep writing and read a lot. And I've dedicated a book to each of them, they are so incredibly supportive and they've always, you know, wanted me to write. And actually my father is from a place called Siglufjörður where my first series took place. So he was really helpful with that particular series because he knew that area well.
Is that where that fantastic hotel is, where they filmed a lot of the TV show Trapped? Is that Siglufjörður?
Yeah, Siglufjörður, yeah, exactly.
This is great. This is where, Matt, I'm now going to become an Icelandic boar.
Oh, good. Here we go.
We can just talk about that. Do you get, but on the tourism side, Ragnar, do you get the sense that Iceland is changing at all? I mean, anyone who wants to know why it's a culture that has remained pretty much the same for a long time, just look at a map. But I wonder, with the amount of attention coming your way, the success of the football team, the huge culture which is coming out of Iceland, the music that comes out of Iceland, whether there is that sense amongst Icelandic people that their culture is changing.
No, not really. I think the only change that is I may be slightly concerned about is the fact that, you know, the impact of the English language is becoming ever more apparent, and that has nothing to do with the tourists really. It has more to do with just the way the media is set up. The, you know, people are watching more English language media and reading more in English. And I'm slightly concerned that you know we need to be careful and keep the Icelandic language up there, so people keep writing in Icelandic and keep reading in Icelandic. But with the with the influx of tourists, I mean, I absolutely love that, and I've missed the tourists. I mean, we have had now a year and a half without tourists in Iceland, and it's the place isn't as much fun without the tourists. And now we're getting them finally back, and I love it. I mean, everything is more vibrant. The restaurants are opening up again. The hotels are opening up again. You go out in the evening downtown, and it's filled with people. So I think, the attention Iceland is getting is just fantastic. And please continue to visit.
Yes. And Matt, you'll love it for many reasons. Plus, the Icelandic people, it seems to me, are the cleanest people. I've never been anywhere where there are instructions as to how you shower. And if you're not showering, and also if you're not showering in the right way and showering the right bits and pieces, then someone will tell you that you should be doing that. And that is...
Hang on, how is that enforced? Like, I mean, if I'm in the desert, when I'm having a shower, 99% of the time, I am alone in the cubicle. No. How is someone telling
someone
me?
Someone will come in and say, you're not washing properly. This is true, Ragnar, isn't it? There are instructions as to how to clean yourself.
Yeah. And you're very right. I mean, either the guard at the swimming pool will come and tell you how to do this properly, or just the Icelanders themselves, because they'll be watching you as well. They'll be, making sure everyone's adhering to these rules. It's strange, but that's the way it is. It's our swimming pool culture. We have a pool in every village. There's a heated thermal pool, and in Reykjavik, I mean, dozens of them, and it's one of our, Iceland's favorite hobbies is to go swimming.
Yeah. Well, it's a culture clash, I think, Ragnar, between the British way of doing things and where, like Matt, you pretend you're the only person there, and the Icelandic way of doing things, which is to study and to make sure you do it properly. So, as long as you're forewarned, you're forearmed, and everything is, and then, then you can expect it, and you'll be very welcome, but only if you cleaned yourself properly. before you go, I'm aware, Ragnar, it's your holiday and we're taking up a lot of your time. What do you write in the summer, or do you just keep it for the darker days?
So I just keep it for the darkness. As I mentioned, I mean, in the summertime, it's bright and nice, and you just want to be outside. You want to be outside reading or just enjoying the summer. But I never write my novels in the summer. But what really happens is I start to, miss writing. So I usually, would go out and write a short story or something to keep the imagination going. So I've just finished one short story last week. And I do something, but it has more of a holiday feel to it, because in the winter I pretty much write every day, and I wouldn't go to sleep until I've finished, doing one chapter or whatever it would.
Yeah. And what is that? What are we going to see from you next, Ragnar, after The Girl Who Died, which is the book we're talking about? What do we see that's new from you next?
Yeah. So it's a book called Outside, and I'm working on that both in English and Icelandic at the moment, because it's out in Iceland before Christmas, and it's already translated. So it's the one. It's out early next year in the UK as well, and that's set in the Icelandic Highlands in winter, and we have a group of friends, four people. So again, few characters. We go out to hunt in November, and they get lost in a snowstorm and have to seek refuge in a cabin. And when they open the cabin, they see something so terrifying that the whole trip takes a different turn, and this whole book is just set in over the course of a day and a half in this cabin and in the snowstorm. And I have to say, I really enjoyed writing that. It's a standalone as well, so, you know, anything can happen to anyone in that book.
Wow. I'm looking forward to that already. Ragnar, you must, if you will, we'd love to talk to you again when that book comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is it true? Because you mentioned the winter. Is it true that the cult is another cultural thing that at Christmas every Icelandic person gets a book, goes to bed, and eats chocolate? That's what I
Yeah, that is right. I mean, every Christmas, all the books more or less in Iceland are published before Christmas in hardback and given as Christmas presents. So you would expect an Icelander to get a lot of books for Christmas and even buy some for himself. I mean, I do that. I buy a few books for myself because I just want to make sure I get the right books that I enjoy. And then on Christmas Eve, we have the Christmas dinner, and then we open the gifts, and you open your book. And when everyone's opened their presents, I think you can fairly well generalize that most Icelanders would take their book of choice and find a nice reading corner by the fire or by a candle, and open the box of chocolates as well, because that is a strong tradition as well. And then you just read into the night. So you read into, you know, Christmas Eve. You know, you try and stay awake for as long as you can into the night with your lights on, and just read and. And that's usually, you know, you save the book that you're most excited for at any given year. You would save that for Christmas Eve.
Fantastic. I love The Girl Who Died, Ragnar. I don't think I'd want to read it at 3 o'clock in the morning with a candle guttering next to my bed. Ragnar Jonasson, we appreciate you speaking to us. Thank you very much. We'll do the Q&A with you on the next podcast, so stand by for that. But The Girl Who Died is new from Ragnar Jonasson. Ragnar, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.